are you?
I'm Batman.
Welcome, podcast listeners of Gotham, to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, look at the entire Batman franchise.
To the Batmobile! This could be the break we've been looking for!
Join Dark Knight Garrett Collins.
You look fine.
I didn't ask.
Boy Wonder Matthew Goudreau.
This is why Superman works alone.
And the world's greatest podcast detective, Adam Bunch.
Loose to plague us with his criminal conundrums.
As they look at most of the cinematic incarnations of Gotham's favorite vigilante crime fighter.
You must be joking.
Do I look like I'm joking?
From the Adam West, Burt Ward starring Batman 66.
Some days you just can't get rid of a bomb.
To Tim Burton's late 80s, early 90s take.
I believe the word you're looking for.
All the way through Matt Reeves, Robert Pattinson starring The Batman.
2 years of nights have turned me into a nocturnal animal.
These podcasters take the Rogues Gallery journey through one of the most popular comic book franchises of all time.
This town needs an enema.
So start up your podcast mobile.
Fortune smiles, another day of wine and roses. Or in your case, beer and pizza. Ha!
And make sure your butler doesn't let your girlfriend in on the secret.
Has anybody ever told you you have a serious impulse control problem?
That the percolated media Batman retrospective begins now.
Let's kick some ice.
Joker, fully adieu. Released October, could there be any more pretentious title? Released October 4th, 2024. Budget on this is allegedly $200 million. We'll talk about it. Box office, at the time we record this, is $166.7 million. Ouch. And this is directed by Todd Phillips. Well, from what I learned, the title of this movie means Madness of Two. Will it cause the Madness of Three in the next 2 hours or so we record this? That's what we're here to answer. Before I get to the movie, I gotta ask you guys something. Matt, you go ahead and go first. I thought 2019 Joker was a one-off. Why are we getting another one?
Did you look at how much money the first one made?
Yeah.
That's my answer in a nutshell. I do believe, for all intents and purposes, that was going to be a one-off. And I was on record saying I didn't like the first Joker. I have not rewatched it since we did our review a couple years ago. But I thought about coming out of COVID and Warner Brothers / DC for that matter. There was kind of a groupthink going on where just because a movie made $1 billion, they greenlit a sequel. Remember, Aquaman made $1 billion, and the sequel to that, much like this, took 5 years to make, or 5 years to release, and was a flop. This, if you're asking me which is the more shocking box office return up to this point, I would go with this, for the sole reason that the Joker name, and by extension Batman, has a lot more general population interest than Aquaman would. So I think the only reason they made this was because powers that be said, God damn it, make another one, because A, we're losing money for a lot of our other properties, and B, we want to capitalize on what made the first one a hit.
They just can't get on a roll, can they? Because they did Beetlejuice, which made a shit ton of money, and now they're releasing this, and it's going to end up losing them money.
Yeah, they're putting all their baskets in another musical coming out next month.
Oh, yeah. Jeez. All right, Adam, as the one who championed the first film much more than the other two, I re-listen to our podcast from that movie that we recorded a couple years ago. I was not able to re-watch it. But Adam, you were the one who championed it the most. Were you looking forward to a sequel?
It's amazing that, much like Matt, this is a movie I didn't want, I didn't need, and I didn't think would happen. And I was good with that. And the differences between us, or between all three of us, is, yeah, I adore the first one. Weird thing to say, because it is a fucked up movie. But I love everything about the way that it's made, its nihilism, the questions that it poses, that I can watch it almost like I watch so many of Chris Nolan's films, where it's a choose-your-own-adventure depending on what I want to believe. Did he kill himself at this point, at that point, at this point? Is it real? Is it not? I love a lot about that first film. I appreciate it in the art style that he did, and I know a lot of people are going to take that with a skepticism because, yes, he absolutely ate so many other filmmakers that came before, but I believe he does it lovingly. All that said, when they were putting out the advance notices of this, I thought they were just fucking with people. Hey, we're doing Joker 2 as a musical. I'm like, wait, you're fucking serious? And then it was, we're getting Lady Gaga. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's a funny fucking what? For everybody that's complaining they didn't know this was a musical, I don't know where the fuck you've been the last 3 years, because they made it clear that's what this movie was.
Did they, but, though? Because
yes, they did.
Press leading up, they were like, well, it's not really a musical. It could be, but...
It's not a musical in the traditional sense, but they made it clear this was a musical. They've said it in every interview from before this thing started filming. But,
so, I gotta step in and side with Garrett. They, being Todd Phillips, Scott Silver and company, did put it out there that this was a jukebox musical, and we'll talk about their comments and how they kind of walked it back. But the marketing, the trailers, gave next to no indication. So much so that they never showed any of the musical numbers beyond the movements, and you never saw people actually singing. So I think this was Warner Brothers, and we're seeing this with Wicked, the most popular musical of the last 20 years. If you watch that trailer, the first one, you would not think it's a musical. And you're seeing the same thing here, because musicals have not been doing well at the box office over the last decade plus. Look at this. Look at West Side Story bombed. So I think this was a ploy by Warner Brothers to conceal, at least to audiences who only see trailers, that it's a musical.
From that point, I'll agree, yeah. If you watch the trailers or the TV spots, it doesn't let you know, or it doesn't shout out it's a musical. And yeah, the first couple trailers of Wicked made no mention that it was a musical, and now they're only just starting to be like, oh shit, this whole thing's about music. So yeah, at that point, yes, I'll agree with you. I guess maybe I'm just a little too in the know that when people feign ignorance, I roll my eyes at it.
Fair enough. I understand that. Let's get into a little bit of the origin of this. It's really weird. When this was coming out, Todd Phillips was adamant. It's a one-off. We're not going to do any more. But apparently, while they were filming it, Joaquin Phoenix did come up to him and say, hey, I just had a dream that would make a great sequel. I dreamt that I was on stage and I was singing and then telling jokes as the Joker. And maybe we can get a quote-unquote, this is what he said, a female Joker. Proof that he read about as many comic books as Tim Burton did to be in it as well. And from there, Todd Phillips kind of ran with it, and we got what we ended up getting with Lady Gaga cast as Harley Quinn. So Joaquin Phoenix had the idea for this. They started working on it, and then, as we've mentioned, the press started coming out that it was a musical, and then we heard that Lady Gaga was cast, which, I mean, look, she gets a lot of praise for what she did with A Star Is Born, and I think it's just my bias against that movie. I don't like that movie at all. I guess she was good in it. I did think Bradley Cooper kind of outshined her a little bit in that role. But she has proven she is trying to do something. Now, Adam, as you and I, both big-time closeted Gaga fanboys, what did you think when you heard that Lady Gaga was cast as Harley Quinn?
First, I rolled my eyes for a number of reasons. I didn't need Harley because we've had Harley recently. I felt like they were just throwing stuff, not even against the wall, just throwing stuff in a pot and just pulling out whatever they could at the bottom of this cauldron, because it just seems random. And with the changes on top of it, and with DC Studios being formed, and this was already in the mix beforehand, so was Matt Reeves' The Batman. I didn't know if either of these were going to be done. Should they even be done? Will it continue? So everything felt a little awkward. Gaga, however, if we were going to go that route, I was okay with it. I think she has taken what Madonna wanted to be from stage and screen and been able to do it more competently. I don't mean that to be an insult to Midge. I love Body of Evidence, but
I don't know if that's ever been uttered.
But I think she has shown that she puts an effort into it just like she does in music. She's going to do something. She's actually going to put effort. And I did think, at least once it was confirmed, that she was going to do something with the role that was different. But I loved Margot Robbie, so I didn't need Lady Gaga doing the exact same thing that I thought was done really well recently.
Candlewax did all the work in Body of Evidence, if you've ever seen that. Matt, how about you, sir? What'd you feel? We're already getting a sequel. We heard that. And then we're hearing Lady Gaga is being cast as Harley Quinn. What were you feeling?
That sounded like a decision that was made in a boardroom, not necessarily for creative integrity. I liked her a lot in A Star Is Born, and while I did not like House of Gucci on the whole, I thought she was the one person who understood the assignment, that it was a Telemundo brought to the big screen. And I think she's closer to like a Cher or even a Tina Turner when it comes to making that transition, where I think she has a lot more acting chops than you would expect. And I definitely think she has the magnetism to be a movie star, but I'm sort of the opposite end of Adam, where I loved Margot Robbie's performance for the most part as Harley Quinn, but I didn't necessarily like their take on the character. Granted, it started from a place I did not like in Suicide Squad, and they were kind of stuck with that. They tried to get around it as best they could, do some updates, but that template was still in existence. So in the same way that I've been jokered out, I'm kind of sick of Harley Quinn. I think they're both very overexposed in the pantheon of Batman, but having seen recently Caped Crusader on Amazon, their version of Harley Quinn is a radical take compared to what was initially established. So seeing that in conjunction with this gave me a little bit more reluctancy to give it a shot.
So they're making this. We're starting to see some press photos leak from set, most of which are scenes that are not in this movie. And then around September, when they premiered it at the Venice Film Festival, we started hearing the stink come off saying, you know, it's not really that good. And in the lead up, since September, boys, I don't think I've ever seen a movie get so derided by, I mean, let's face it, we don't really have critics anymore. We have influencers, right? So a lot of people that I know, look, I have deleted, out of my 5 former social media accounts, I have deleted all but one, and that's my Facebook account. I've deleted what used to be Twitter. I've deleted Instagram. I've deleted all of them. But it was really hard to not see that there was word that this movie was pretty terrible. Matt, what were you feeling in hearing that when you went and saw the movie?
It kind of reminded me of Dial of Destiny, but to a bigger extent, where one of the things I think this movie had to combat, beyond just people saying, oh, you made this for the money, is a couple weeks to almost a month of negative publicity. When you're already going into a movie with the consensus for what it is, you know, the majority, if you're looking at numerical scores on pretty much every website or aggregator you can find, this movie has not been doing well. I think that does create a certain bias for when you walk into the theater, especially if you're someone like me who did not like the first one. So my rationale is, what is it about this one that even people who love the first film or even like it to a mild degree seem to be turning on this one? So I will say I was not excited to go see this, but it did pique my curiosity because I was expecting something that would surprise me.
All right, Adam, 70th percentile of people who did not like this movie, that is critics and audiences. You were the big fan, as I mentioned, of the previous one. What were you feeling when you finally got to see this?
When I saw the scores start to come out, when I saw the news start to come out, the hubbub from all the stuff, and people just want, stop talking about how long something gets a standing ovation at these film festivals, because Kevin Smith can get up, take a shit on stage, and we'll get an 8-minute standing ovation for it. So please stop talking about how long these movies get
ovations for. He did that. It was called Red State.
Brilliant film.
Shit.
And love that part. But I was not only intrigued, it made me a little more excited. Because as much as everybody jumped on the Joker bandwagon once it left the station, I don't feel like it's a giant mass appeal movie. And that's part of the thing that I love about it. And I thought this was even more so of, look, this isn't a superhero movie. This isn't a Marvel movie. This isn't even freaking Bloodshot. Just going to be a random, more nihilistic type of film. And I thought it was going to be kooky and wacky. And I did think that was the only way that you were bringing not only Todd Phillips back, but I thought that you had to do something completely out of left field if you were going to get Joaquin Phoenix to come back for this. So when I heard that critics didn't like it, if anything else, I'm like, fucking good. I hope I will. I can't say that it made me think I definitely would, but to not make a movie specifically for critics, I was kind of happy about that.
Well, I will say one of the things that perked my ears up as I was going on the various websites, I saw, I don't pay attention to cinema score whatsoever, but when I heard this has the lowest score of any comic book movie ever made, and you think about what that encapsulates, in the same year that Madam Web came out, we've had Morbius, we've had Batman and Robin, like some of the most infamous blockbusters have been comic book films, And people still found more enjoyment out of those, apparently, than they did with Joker. And to your point, I'm going to play some conspiracy theorist. I don't think it's a coincidence that they announced Joker 2 around the same time that Marvel announced Hugh Jackman was coming back to play Wolverine. Both of these movies have come out this year. Deadpool and Wolverine has grossed over $1 billion, and this has crapped the bed. So we've had two returns that I never thought I would see for a variety of reasons. Joaquin just didn't seem to me to be someone that would reprise a character. And I thought Hugh Jackman would leave Wolverine by the bedside, but I guess when you dump a truck full of money up to an actor's house, they'll sign up for anything.
And to me, that's the only way this budget is anything close to what's being reported, is that if he got in the neighborhood of Robert Downey Jr. money.
Yeah, Todd Phillips has denied that it's $200 million, which is why I said it's allegedly $200 million. But I got to say, I think a lot of that, you know, you're bringing in Joaquin Phoenix, who's probably got to demand at least 30. You have Lady Gaga, you have Todd Phillips, and of course, like I said, Joaquin Phoenix, who won an Oscar for the previous one, by the way. We never mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be the majority of what made this budget the way it is, because we're going to get into the film, but we go into Arkham and we go into a courtroom, and that's pretty much it.
It feels like what they spent on screen was less than they spent last year.
Yeah,
I can say
because they were like on locations in the last film.
I can say between Phillips, Gaga, and Joaquin, yeah, I think you could easily have spent $80 million getting those three back.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, at Warner Brothers, you have to go, look, that's a fraction of the profit from Joker and the prestige of Warner Brothers getting the best actor win. I mean, that is a big deal. Mm-hmm. So I do think that in the grand scheme of things, and I also think that there's a lot of amortization of costs that studios, I mean, come on, the studio system is a money laundering gimmick. It's a money laundering scheme to set taxes, then they get tax credits, so screw that all. But you can't tell me that they spent $200 million on this film. I don't believe it, and I do think that is some of the press that loves to shit on Warner Brothers and DC. If this was Marvel, there is no way this would be getting the bad press that it is.
I can't say that for certainty, but I do think there is an implication with all the change that has happened. I mean, in a lot of ways, this was kind of a dead man walking. Not the movie, but we already knew while this was in production that the status quo was being shaken up. We knew James Gunn was coming in to sort of take the reins. So my thought process was, is this movie even going to lead to anything? Because what you could say about the first one is that that movie ends with you having the roadmap to say, oh, I guess now he's the Joker and we're going to start to get more outlandish. But with all the factors that have gone into this movie and its production and the box office, and certainly with the movie itself, I see no way they continue this.
No, I'm not seeing Harley Quinn gather an army and do her own thing. There's no way I can see that at all. And I don't think it's meant to. I started digging into Todd Phillips, right? Because all I knew him as the guy who did Old School, was into comedies. He did this big, big freaking Joker movie that eventually ended up grossing over $1 billion. And now he's doing this other one. This guy started off documenting G.G. Allen. And anybody who knows who G.G. mm-hmm. Allen is, go Google him. It is the definition of punk. And I'm telling you right now, this movie is the definition of punk. I think he went that route with it. I think this is a big finger to everybody who loved that last movie. And I'll get into reasons why, but that's a choice. It's a choice.
So I made the, I don't want to call it a mistake, but I listened to Todd Phillips' commentary track for the first movie. Since I didn't have time to rewatch it, but I could listen to that, uh-huh. You know, while I'm working and stuff. And we're going to get into this. I don't know if Todd Phillips understands either movie he made, based on what he says in his commentary track and in interview.
I'll be interested to hear that as we get into it.
I don't have a whole lot of details as far as, like, line by line what he says in the commentary, but there's one point that I said, oh, you simpleton. You have no idea. Remember, this is the guy who nuked his previous franchise with the Hangover sequels. He did the same thing. He took a first movie that made almost $1 billion. I don't know how much it made. And said, all right, I'll come back. And he made, with the second one, this really gross, mean-spirited, borderline masochistic sequel. And then the third one is just a crime drama. So this guy has experience with lighting a cigarette and doing like Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight and just burning a pile of money.
No, I was astonished because I've only seen part of the very first Hangover, so I had no idea that he had just gone off in different directions with the other ones. It makes me laugh at this.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable to look at those other two, although I wouldn't recommend it.
No, don't.
All right, so let's get into our theatrical experiences. I went in a week after it was already out. Jen told me, this is your thing, you go. She wanted no part of this movie. I went, and believe it or not, the theater I went to, half full. People were there. I was astonished at that. And by the time it was over, boy, I had some feelings. The fact that it was already out a week, you know, I'd already heard everything about it. As much as I tried to avoid it, as I mentioned, I deleted most of my social media. You couldn't avoid it. It was everywhere. The CinemaScore, everything. Hell, even Jen knew. Oh, God, Joker's getting terrible reviews. Now, I want to go to Matt next, because Matt, you were the one who saw this opening weekend. What was your theater like? What was your experience like?
About half full, maybe a little bit more. And there was vocal confusion, because clearly there were people who had no idea this was a musical based on their reactions. I was in the middle to the back of the theater in the last third section, but I was sitting in the middle so I could do a full 360 and read the room. And when the movie was done, I almost wanted to do my own dance down the steps and just laugh at all the people who were leaving the theater, a lot of them visibly pissed.
Oh, wow. Now, Adam, you did not let us know when you were seeing this. You saw this, I'm guessing, around the same time I did, a week after it was out, right?
I saw this Thursday of opening week. Yeah, or sorry, nope, it was Friday. I just remembered because the family was going scout camping, so they left as I was leaving to go see the movie. I saw it at 3 p.m., so it was a little earlier. I caught the final matinee pricing, Dolby Digital. I got my leather recliner, great seats, good popcorn, wonderful icy. I was in as good, and I have shit on my local AMC a lot recently. It was as good as they've done in a while, so I was happy with that. About a third full, but it was a little earlier in the day on a Friday, and I can't say the crowd was animated. I don't think anybody was pissed as we left, but there was a lot of quizzical looks. Almost everybody was looking around to everybody else, kind of a, should we all sit and talk about what the fuck we just saw? It was that, you know, thought as everybody was walking out. It was silent, and everybody was kind of quizzical.
Were you solo as I was?
I was solo. Laura had no desire to go see this movie, and this is not one. Even if the kids wanted to, I don't think I would have taken them to this one, just because I didn't know what this thing was going to be.
Was there anyone snoring in your theater this time?
No, for the first time in a while, there's not someone snoring in this movie, and I'm not saying that they wouldn't have been justified. We'll discuss that here in just a second, but I will say there was no one snoring because it was still light outside. If I would have waited till the next showing, possibly.
Matt, you went solo too?
Yeah, my drummer blew up like in Spinal Tap, so I went by myself.
All right, so we're starting off with a Joker cartoon called Me and My Shadow, done by, God, and I'm going to butcher this name, Sylvain Comey, who actually did an Academy Award nominated animated film called Triplets of Belleville, if anyone's seen that. Now, in this short, we're seeing Joker show up to a theater, take out some guards, and then he's performing. A lot gets performed in this short. A lot gets conveyed in this short, which ends with him getting beat to shit by a bunch of police officers. Boys, right off the bat, Phillips is putting you on your toes, like, okay, what are we watching here?
I kind of audibly scoffed when I saw the old school, like, Looney Tunes Warner Brothers logo. I half expected the music to kick in, too. This will speak to my larger thesis on this movie. I could have walked outside and smelled the pretentiousness outside of the theater with the amount of stuff that happens. And it starts immediately with the literalization of looking at his shadow as the separate personality, the Joker, versus Arthur, who's the one that's trapped in that box. It's well animated. The color scheming is really cool. But Todd Phillips thinks he's a genius. But in reality, this is like philosophy 101, especially with his quote about the first one being a comedy and this one being a tragedy. I'm like, oh my God, go fuck yourself, and I'm 5 minutes in.
And there's posters of musicals everywhere. We even have a nice portrait of Robert De Niro seen here as well. Yeah, definitely setting you up for what you're about to see. Adam, what'd you feel about this?
This was an amazing way to open the film. the reason was I didn't expect it. I could not believe that we were doing this. Now, to Matt's point, you literalize so much in this opening. And I do think when you look at the first film, I think that's problematic. Because what I love about that first one is its ambiguity. You can take it, as I said, kind of a choose-your-own-adventure. You can decide almost what you believe in that way the movie goes. I think this spoon feeds a lot more, but I think this is such an offbeat, offhanded, ballsy way to start this thing. I love the two shadows. I like this as much as it's in your face. The three of us don't need this, and I think most of the crowd would need this kind of duh, you know, literalization of it. Unfortunately, you're not going to have big enough crowds to see this. But I think this opening is ballsy, and I love that they went for it.
This is how we're starting, huh? We joke for him today, and we follow him through the asylum. Now, Adam, correct me if I'm wrong. This is pretty much echoing what the audience is feeling, right? Like, okay, are you going to tell a joke? Are you going to be the Joker? This is a theme that is conveyed throughout this entire film, right?
Yeah, this movie is a discussion with the audience. Plain and simple. This movie is a discussion with the audience from Joker. It's a discussion with journalists. It's a discussion with the talking heads. 2019's Joker, what they said about it, what they didn't say about it, and how they responded to it. That's what this movie is. And once the cartoon sequence ends, that's the story that's being told. And I can't believe that everybody at Warner Brothers said, sure, that's the script we're going to green light and give you money for.
The funny thing is, James Gunn did have notes on the script when he got it, and fucking Todd Phillips just threw the notes out.
Which is my favorite
part of the making of this movie.
He should have nothing to do with this. You need to have that delineation line, end the DC universe, and start the new one. That includes Batman, as far as I'm concerned.
By definition, it is a conversation, but what good conversations involve both people talking to each other. This movie feels like a sermon, and it's self-aware antagonism towards the audience. Garrett said the word, I'm going to kick down the door. This is the most expensive middle finger I have ever seen. this is the Rob Zombie Halloween 2.
Oh my God, that's in my notes too. Fuck.
I said that was the movie I was going to use as my comparison, in that you have the first film, which is what it is. Got a fan base, the director clearly had a take, and then they made a second movie that is filled with nothing but contempt for the audience who loved that first movie, and they just did whatever they wanted. And also, Adam touched on this, that one of the things that you can do with the first movie is there's a lot of ambiguity about the distortion of what's real versus what's a hallucination. This opening starts a trend where it recontextualizes the first movie. So clearly, the ending of the first movie with the "you wouldn't get it," that is a hallucination. Because now he is utterly docile, doesn't talk, there's no remnants of the Joker, so we know that was a hallucination. And I think that creates a problem, because by doing that, you're entirely recontextualizing the end of the first movie, where he becomes the Joker, and now we're doing character regression, where he's what he was at the start of the first movie.
What Todd Phillips has done with this movie is he has shifted the point of view from the Joker to the victims. And I think that is going to piss a lot of people off. And the reason why, you know, we always talk about our theatrical experiences, but the big reason why I wanted to talk to you guys about yours is because that's exactly what the audience is feeling right now. They're feeling pissed. They wanted to see Joker get his army together and take over Gotham. We're not going to get that here. We're recontextualizing that first film, and we are examining that first film. And Matt, it's so ironic that you watched that commentary, or you listened to that commentary, I'm sorry, because I feel like this is a commentary to the audience. This is Todd Phillips saying, look, I made the movie I wanted to make. It got really loved. And this is me putting it right back in your face. So again, this is the guy who documented G.G. Allen, and that's a very punk thing to do. You're not giving the audience what you want with this. Again, that's a choice, and I'll talk about whether I like that choice or not. It's obvious that the audiences don't, because they're not going to it. Now, this is our reintroduction to Arthur, a.k.a. Joaquin Phoenix. Now, he got some press earlier this year. He really fucked over Todd Haynes on his production. He might be seeing litigation for that.
As he should.
I'm with you on that. Fucking absolutely. What was it, like 2-3 weeks before it was supposed to go into production?
Not even. It was like a week.
Fuck. So here he is, returning to his Oscar-winning role. He is so gaunt once again. What I have to say about the movie, and this might go back to 2019, what I will say about this movie has nothing to do with what I'm about to say here. I think he's just as good here.
I'm not going to say just as good, because there is a certain amount of familiarity. Like, there's not that surprise component like there was with the first one, but I think it's pretty close. I think the accusations that he phoned this in are a step too far.
I think he's okay. Yeah, I think you may be right. I think it was such a transformative performance last time. I think when you get a little more of the same, it lessens, and that may not be fair, because he's definitely putting out an effort. But when we first see Arthur in the first film, this is such, when you see him so gaunt and wasted away, it does something to you and it gets a reaction. Seeing him this way, it doesn't get much of a reaction, and the one it gets out of me isn't a good one. I don't kind of understand what we're getting here and the why and everything else, so I don't care for it. And he's so gaunt, I was like, did they decide to CG him this time? Because there was a lot of news about how he just weathered himself down for the first one. I didn't hear that news for this, so I was surprised to see just how wasted away he looked. I mean, this is a Leto and McConaughey type weathering down of his body again, and it's just, oof.
And this movie is almost monochromatic with how white and black tones kind of seep into it. And I'm telling you, I almost felt like I was watching Schindler's List, watching him walk around this fucking asylum, like just how skinny and just wasted away, as you mentioned. It's pretty insane.
On that point, Schindler's List is beautiful in its black and white shooting. This movie in the asylum is ugly. It is an ugly palette that it decides to use here.
Oh, I disagree. I think this movie is actually just as gorgeous as the last film. And I didn't have many good things to say about the previous film. What I did say is I thought it looked good. I think this movie, it's in my notes later too, I think this movie looks pretty damn good.
I think a lot of the production aspect is consistent with the first one. I mean, the color grading, it feels like that same world. I liked the asylum, which is really more of a prison because there's really not much reconfiguring outside of musical therapy, apparently. But this is how state-run prisons were at this time. I'm glad this wasn't a Shawshank Redemption type of prison, where I'm like, I'm sorry, if that feels like really Hollywoodized. I like that this is more akin to like Bad Boys with Sean Penn, where prison life is just disgusting and gross.
Nice reference. We have more questions asked to Arthur, whether he has a joke for them, and then he gets shaving cream put on him as he gets shaved, which is the closest to him having makeup on for quite a while. And he's going through the B ward, and he catches a glimpse of who we'll know as Lee, played by Lady Gaga. Now, this is obviously Harley Quinn. We'll only have that mentioned, what, maybe once later on in the film. And from this moment on, I mean, she pretty much gravitates to Arthur. How do we feel Lady Gaga does here?
So before I get to that, one of the things I don't like about this movie, to go back to the previous scene, and this ties into the opening, is that there's always a very clear delineation between what's real and what's not. Because they show the umbrellas at one point, the overhead shot where they're like green and purple, I think, and then it cuts and they're gray.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this movie is spoon-feeding people who bitched about the ambiguity of the first one. So I find that frustrating because you're not giving your audience any credit. And I think that's also a message statement for this movie. Because Todd Phillips is basically saying you are all morons for liking the first movie. Because you quote-unquote didn't see the point. As far as Lady Gaga goes, I was shocked at how, given the marketing, she's relatively underused. Considering you think she would be the co-lead of the movie. I mean, she is probably by default. But she doesn't really overtake the movie in any way. I think she does a good job. But I wasn't really enamored with this take on the character. For the most part. There's one thing I really like. But outside of that, this ties into my theory once again that the only reason these movies got made is because they had the Batman license. You could strip all the Batman stuff away from this movie and it affects nothing. It would still function at least as far as what it's trying to convey. And I also find that frustrating because you're basically, you're whoring out the Batman license to get a movie made. And to a certain extent, I felt that in the first one. But I felt it to a larger extent in this
one. See, I felt it more in the last one than this one.
I was really wondering what type of character she was going to get to it. And I see Stefani, her legal name, what she's deciding to bring to this. I don't see her deciding to Gaga up a lot of this, and that makes me happy. I do think she's trying to give a performance that is completely different from any version of Harley Quinn that we've gotten before. I'm happy to see that. I don't need it, but I don't mind it. It's fine. To Matt's point, yeah, you're introducing Batman stuff into this that is inconsequential. But when it comes to Gareth's point, the last film, I wish we would have had a lot less of the Batman connection. Those were my problems with Joker. So it's good. I do think from the moment Joker takes a walk with the guards, remind me as we wrap this film, I think there's something being done here that we're going to get revealed later on, and I mean years later on. So I don't think everything is as we're seeing it.
So Arthur meets up with his public defender lawyer, played by Catherine Keener, and she's pissed that he didn't have an umbrella through the rain. Now, this is a movie, as I mentioned in the beginning, it's called Folie à Deux, which means Madness of Two. This movie's in pairs. And I think Catherine Keener and Lady Gaga both do a bit of tug of war, where Catherine Keener is more with Arthur, and Lee is more for the Joker. We'll see as we go on. Like, she wants that Joker to come out. She speaks for the audience, I think, in this. The people who like that first movie, anyway, that she wants that Joker. I caught that bit of a story beat. Adam, did you catch that these two are going for different parts of his personality, right?
These are the different reactions to Joker. And Harley is the audience reaction that the press loved to yell and scream about. Oh, that was the part of the audience that they thought were going to start doing shootings and burning it down. Those were the people that idolized the Joker incel part of the movie in 2019. And that's who Harley represents, and that's who we're seeing here. Everything that she does is that part of the audience, especially when it comes to the end of this film and what that character does. The other people here are on the side of Joker being an art house movie, and that's what his public defender is, and that's what this film is. It is two sides of that. It is two sides of how the story was told. That gets really obvious when we meet the prosecutor here in just a bit. It is that split.
It's so funny. When I re-listened to our review of the first Joker, I was asking what an incel was in that podcast. Different world.
This is one of the problems about how this movie is kind of revising, in a lot of ways contradicting the first film. There's a difference between retconning events versus recontextualizing the entire premise of the previous movie, which this one is. The first movie is Arthur getting revenge on people who were mean to him. So much so that Todd Phillips literally says in his commentary, that movie's about kindness. Which also, go fuck yourself for saying that. And he says at the end of the commentary, this is the sticking point I have, he said, Joker is who he was all along. Clearly that is not true based on the movie he makes here. So again, I think this guy does not understand, either he doesn't understand the first movie he made, or he's purposefully rebelling against all the success it had. Now, the first one, we complained about some of the Batman components that were pushed in. This one, though, makes it even worse, because they never mention that the Waynes got shot. They're never mentioned in this movie.
Let's not forget, too, this takes place in, what, 1983, so 2 years after the first
Which is a huge problem, because that was part of the spark of him shooting De Niro on TV, was, like, inciting the riots and going after the rich. So when he's put on trial later on, that should be discussed, the fallout of what happened. Instead, they keep it to just the people he killed, not necessarily the societal implications that he lit with a cigarette, which, again, not since Tony Scott's The Hunger have I seen a movie fetishize smoking.
Yeah. But you know what? I don't think this movie's about that, though. That's the weird thing about this movie, is he is saying that the Joker is not real. The Joker is a concept. The Joker is a shadow. The Joker is a conceit. It is an influence to people around him. We'll get to somebody he influences in this movie later on, but I'm saying right now that there is no Joker in this movie. This is the concept, and this is the influence of it, liking this.
That's fine, but then don't get mad at the people who are upset that you made a movie called Joker with the DC logo on it and shit on them for having certain expectations. And again, furthers my theory, he used that license to get these stories made.
All right, so the public defender does say that the doctor thinks due to Arthur's childhood, he has split personality. And what I was going to say is, you know, in 1983, we had a lot of things that pointed to split personalities, which has since been discredited. A movie called Sybil came out, talked about split personality. That's been discredited. So this was a whole thing in the early 80s, was we're going to make them say that they have split personality to try to get them all.
Yeah, I mean, it was an absolute thing that defenders used a bunch in these type of trials. So split personality was a headline type of thing, especially back then. I mean, we throw random shit at the headlines now for attention and to get people off. DID wasn't a thing then. DID literally has a textbook now that updates annually for psychiatrists to understand. So yeah, it's a different time. It's a different place. When you're putting it in this context in this film, it does muddy the waters.
It's further accentuated by the fact that, again, it's never inferred that he has like a split personality in the first one. It's more of that self-discovery.
It was the push into it. It was the one bad day. It was the killing joke type mentality of anybody can get pushed into this. So it was his descent into becoming whatever you want to call that character. But yeah, there was no split personality of Arthur and Joker. Nothing in that first one ever made me feel like there was two different people there.
No, delusions of grandeur and hallucinations do not automatically associate DID. Like, that's an entirely different disorder.
Well, especially because when it started, like his fascination with Murray and being in the audience, he didn't always do that as Joker. He did that as Arthur.
Arthur sort out what happened and that she's here for him. He then asks for a cigarette as he tells her about what happened with the three men on the subway, as well as when he shot Murray Franklin, of which he says he just remembers the music. Oh boy. She tells him that he came out dressed as Joker, and he does an impression of his mother, and he's asked if Joker came out after his mom died.
Garrett, this is the psychiatrist scenes in Split.
Oh, yeah.
They're framed the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a bit of Glass with the whole, like, Sarah Paulson character. So I do like that everyone in this movie is kind of using Arthur to get what they want. But at the same time, this movie also feels like, oh, you liked this character? I'm just going to beat him down so relentlessly and make him so pitiful that he's not even that interesting to watch.
Well, what they've done is they've taken away his power. At the end of the last movie, he was on top of the world as this Joker character. And what Todd Phillips has done here is say, look, we're taking away his power. You're going to see him as the pathetic person he actually is. Which is, again, interesting take. So she then asks to speak to Joker, and that's when we cut. We hear Saints come marching in yet again. I swear to God, we hear it so many fucking times here. I thought about using it as the intro to this fucking podcast. As a young inmate asks Arthur to teach him to kiss because he's never been kissed before. He does, and a guard tells him he didn't take him as a hopeless romantic.
I have no idea what this is supposed to do or be. I'm looking for symbolism. I'm looking for a reason.
Good luck.
Yeah.
I don't have one with this. Like, it's...
The only thing is,
to be awkward.
It's framed to be awkward, but the whole thing about this is this character is the one that comes back at the end. So I guess they're setting him up, but to do it this way is pretty odd.
Which, by the way, you see that guy a couple times throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh no, because I knew exactly where this was going. And for the record, I called this when we did the initial review, specifically the notion that he's not the quote-unquote actual Joker. As intended. Granted, the context has changed because this movie's message is there is no Joker.
Mm-hmm.
Which was told, even when that movie came out, it was, this isn't the Joker, it might be a Joker. And people got so upset that that narrative then went away and it was like, well, fuck it, just go watch the movie then. But that was part of the initial thing was, look, it's just a Joker story. But yeah, that person that shows up and just the look, I mean, it's enough that 2 minutes after the animated sequence and Joker's walking out of the cell and he walks into the common room and through it, I have a suspicion how the movie's going to end. Because somebody is in the third of the frame they need to be and is in focus enough that I know they're going to matter by the end.
It also doesn't help that the movie was publicized as having an ending that will quote-unquote piss a lot of people off. So I said, I was going through my head, I'm like, all right, what the nuclear bomb option that would upset the most people? I thought this was 1B. I thought there was one they could have pulled that would have gotten people more upset, but we'll save that for the end.
So this is when we hear that they have made a TV movie based on Arthur's life, which was the whole rage of this time period. Adam, I know you remember this. Remember every week they have like TV movies based on like kids that were kidnapped and serial killers on the loose and things like that. So I kind of went with this.
Yeah, and right now it's what seems to be on every single freaking streaming service.
You're not kidding.
As I watch like three different TV movies about Scott Peterson and the Menendez brothers and the chick kidnapped up here in Vallejo, and I feel like I've been watching a lot of these true crimes lately. But of course, that means we're going to see at least a trailer for this movie, right? Or we're going to see a scene from this. If you're going to set this up like 5 times in this movie, you've got to show us some of this TV movie.
Nah. The more they talk about it, the more it stays in your subconscious, so I didn't really think about that too much.
Well, they should have mentioned at least who played Arthur Fleck, because I'm like, all right, who would it have been? And I'm like, you know what? Probably would have been Mark Harmon.
If they had the sense of humor they think they do, they would have made it Jared Leto.
Oh, God. In 1983?
Good point. Good point.
That's why I said Mark Harmon.
Yeah. So we see Arthur take some pills as we hear music in the background, and we get a close-up through the door. We cut to the next morning where Joker is being told it's showtime and more Saints Go Marching In renditions are heard. We see Arthur join a music group as he's introduced, and then he's told that they use music in that class to make them all whole, and he's set right next to Lee, again played by Lady Gaga. You know what, Matt? You said that she's underused here. The word I use in my notes is underserved. I just think she's underserved here. I think she's kind of just a device.
I think both are applicable.
Yeah, I do think it's important that people know, like, she is really just a supporting. Like, there's no co-lead here. She has as much time in this movie as Michael Keaton did in Beetlejuice. You're stretching to get to 15, 17 minutes.
Arthur goes to her sitting on a window, and she says that she knows who he is, and she says that she's here because she set fire to her parents' apartment building. She also says that she saw the movie made about Arthur 20 times, and that she thought it was good as she lived in the same neighborhood, and that her dad beat her, and that she took the same stairs to school every morning. These fucking stairs that are pretty much like, Matt, we talked about it last year, but kind of like the Exorcist stairs at this point, with how much they're mentioned.
I think as many people have fallen down them.
Yeah. Lee then says that she saw Joker with Murray Franklin, and she hoped that he would blow his brains out like he did. And when he did, she didn't feel alone anymore. She then sings Get Happy, which Arthur is trying to join her in as he's whisked away. He tells the guard what he regrets about being on Murray's show is he didn't shoot first and let him ask questions later. So he's trying to let that Joker out a bit, right, Adam? Like, he's trying to inch it out.
Yeah. This movie takes a turn when he meets Lee. And I gotta say, the first 35, 40 minutes of this film are fucking interminable. It is boring. It is garish. Once he meets her in this singing room, I think it takes a turn. I think he takes a turn. Everything just lightens up a little bit. But yeah, you start to see a little bit of that development, a little bit of that Joker start to come out again. And I think this is Phillips writing this film. He didn't want to do it. He was Arthur sitting in that cell. And I think he's trying to find a way to get some of that Joker back, and I don't think it fully does.
Well, sometimes I think the paradigm is interesting where they sort of do the inverse of their conventional relationship where she's the controller, she's the manipulator, and he's kind of the, I don't want to say dumb, but clearly the subservient one. I think that's an interesting way. If you're going to bring this character in, do something different. But once they leave the asylum, she's kind of in and out for the movie. And they only have like a couple scenes through the phone line. So I don't think it's as explored. It's not like Mad Love did more in 22 minutes exploring that than this entire movie does in 2+ hours, which is why I feel like a lot of it is just a giant waste of time. And I'm not one to bitch about runtimes, but there is no justification for this movie being over 2 hours.
Something they could have taken out, which we'll get to in a bit.
Yeah, there is. I do think there's a way to also introduce Lady Gaga, have her interact with Joker, Arthur, to do all of that, and have it play as a does she exist or does she not? Because of the way that she deliberately interacts with characters that we know are true, it takes away from what would have been a cool thing of is she solely a figment of his imagination? And that could have been fucking a good idea.
Well, Phillips has ripped off enough movies. Why not add Fight Club to that list?
Ugh, because he wants to do good movies?
Ooh. We see it in Who's Conference with Harvey Dent, played by Harry Lally, who looks suspiciously like Chris Nolan here. I seriously thought this was a jab at Nolan.
This shows up, and my first thing is, Matt just threw a soda.
I don't eat or drink during movies because I know if I do, I will wind up in the bathroom at some point, and I don't want to miss anything. But I said, oh, for fuck's sake, which I said multiple times during the first movie, because, again, this is one of those things where they have the Batman toy chest, and they can just pluck whatever they want, even though they do nothing with it. There's no semblance of personality with this character, so to compensate, they make him Harvey Dent.
You know, I thought I was going to have a problem with this, but I didn't. I think the way he prosecutes, he's the enemy here to a lot of people, right? He's trying to give this guy the fucking death penalty. He's trying to put him to death. I really didn't have any issue with this inclusion, but then again, I'm not as versed in the Batman universe as you guys are.
I have a problem with the inclusion because it doesn't do anything. It doesn't improve the character whatsoever. It doesn't make a difference other than the fact that it's Harvey Dent, who was a prosecutor, you do all that. You should have had an amazing cross-examination where you start to see Harvey Dent have an understanding of split personality that we know who he is. But then again, this isn't Harvey's movie, so why do you do it? You don't do that in this film because it doesn't do anything. So it's like him meeting Alfred in the last movie. Fucking why? You just don't have a reason for it other than, hey, I know who's a lawyer in the Batman universe.
Yeah, that's the thing that frustrated me the most is that this character doesn't have a personality. And more importantly, if you change the name, nothing about the character changes.
Nothing changes.
You know, it's like if you call Catherine Keener's character like Leslie Tompkins, as an example, it's still the same character, but she just has a name that people associate with a prominent character. If you were going to use Harvey Dent, you should have had him lose his shit in the courtroom.
Yep.
His split personality comes out, and Arthur gets off because of that.
See, you would have rebelled against that, too, though.
No, but that would have at least been using the character as they have a history of. He's not a character. He's a plot mechanism. And I honestly would not have rebelled against it because I'm still waiting to see Two-Face done properly in a Batman movie.
Well, it's done great in Batman Forever.
Remember, go back, I said I defended that movie a lot.
One-Face.
At least cast a name. Like, I have no fucking clue who this guy is.
This guy is in an HBO show. He's probably working down a lot, which is why they got him. He's in a show called The Industry right now, which I hear is really good.
I hear it's good, but also this kid looks 19.
Yeah, well, that's right. He looks like when two, like, 15-year-olds stack on each other's shoulders and put a big trench coat on so they can sneak into places. Who let this pre-law student be a DA?
Again,
I understand. I understand that you get young people that are working when it's public, but not in a capital murder trial.
I tell you, I'll stand by it. I think the reason that this kid's cast is because he looks so much like Nolan. Because
there's a big FU to Nolan at the end of this movie.
Yes, there is. Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If I was Christopher Nolan, I would actually, I know that guy never shows emotion, but I'm pretty sure he would have snapped.
I think there's a reason that he decided to go with Universal again recently, and I think that might have been the reason. I do think that's the reason.
Part of the restitution check was an apology for this movie.
Yeah, it wasn't big enough. I do see Nolan there, but you know who I do think is cast and is dressed specifically? Is the judge is Martin fucking Scorsese. From the hair to the glasses to the shape of the face.
So Arthur hears that they're seeking the death penalty for him, and he sings a song. And I have to say, big complaint I have about this movie, unsurprisingly, is the fucking music. I don't think they serve the plot at all. I think even when Gaga sings later, it's a disservice to the songs themselves. Because she's a professional singer, and they told her, they said, dumb it down. Get as dirty as you can for these songs and don't let them come out smooth. All the singing in this movie, guys, is fucking terrible. Now, this is being said by a non-musical fan. So I got to ask, what did you think about the inclusion of music here?
I love the musical breaks in this film. Mm. Now, however, I'm going to say this is not a musical in the way musical is done. A musical is vast majority, if not 100%, sung through. The dialogue is not sung. So this is not a musical in a traditional sense. But I think they both do a decent job. I don't want Lady Gaga to perform as Lady Gaga, so I like what she did with it. Garrett, I recommend you actually listen to her Harlequin album that she put out with
this. I did. I listened to it on the way home.
So I like the musical breaks, though I wish they were chapter break, because I think that would make a little more sense in this. I think you could do six songs and break up what's going on in this film a lot better. I do think they're a little too randomized for the placement, and I don't think it comes together story-wise as much as they want. But I like every time we break the song.
You cut these songs out, you'll have a movie that's only a little over 2 hours, not 2 hours, 20 minutes. And I think it slows the film down, and that's a big, big reason why I don't like musicals at all, is because it just slows the fucking music down to just kind of stop and just sing to the fucking audience. I can't stand it. Matt, be the tiebreaker.
So the thing is, to Adam's point, musical has as broad of a definition as horror does in cinema. This is more the jukebox type of musical. Your Mamma Mia's, your Rock of Ages, where they take pre-existing songs and have the characters perform them periodically. But it's also mixed with Chicago, where most of the songs take place outside of the reality of the movie. In a lot of ways, it's like apologizing for being a musical so that they don't take place in reality. And I think most of the musical numbers in this movie suck. It's counterintuitive to have a movie where your characters, primarily, the actors are told to sing, quote-unquote, badly. I don't want Joaquin Phoenix to put out an album, but he's got a decent singing voice for an actor. And Lady Gaga obviously has one of the best voices in music. They're told to sing badly. That's fine, but that should not be the case when they're having their dream sequences in the musical. They should sound how they would in their heads. Like, they should sound, like, amazing. If they did auto-tune the shit out of Joaquin Phoenix as a joke, which, of course, this movie has the sense of humor of a Christopher Nolan movie, that would have actually been pretty insightful and clever. But the musical devices...
should sound produced.
Yeah, should sound overly produced. Like, it should match the absurdity of some of the sets we see later on. So I think they're poorly implemented, and I questioned, why did they go this route outside of Todd Phillips just saying, I'm going to be the Joker, I'm going to burn this motherfucker to the ground, like that hospital in The Dark Knight. That 15-second explosion is a microcosm of this entire movie. Because, remember, Michael Caine's Alfred says, some men just want to watch the world burn. I think that's Todd Phillips' mission statement for this movie.
I agree with that. I was also surprised that the production numbers weren't more grandiose. We're not seeing chicks do kickstands into the screen or anything. We're not seeing anybody else get involved here. It's only these two, which I get, you're going into their psyche. But I agree with you guys in that if you're going to do it, go all out. Why did they just fucking strip it down like this?
Why I don't believe this thing cost $200 million
exactly.
is another reason.
Mm-hmm.
And also, almost all of them are pre-existing songs. I also don't like, though, that there's one scene where they literally steal a scene from Moulin Rouge right down to the same setting. And I was like, oh, God, now they're stealing from other musicals. But again, I get the sense they're, like, apologizing for this being a musical, which is why it was so kind of concealed. And again, Todd Phillips backtracking and saying, oh, it's not a musical. They're using songs to express how they feel. I'm like, you don't understand what a fucking musical is then.
Yeah, and they kind of set this up in the animated short at the beginning, too, because we're seeing posters of musicals.
They're watching.
Was that Singing?
Oh, what is it?
Was that Singing in the Rain? What is that?
No, that's The Bandwagon, because it's Fred Astaire.
Oh, okay. So, Arthur is once again trying to let the Joker out as he's outside in the rain, trying to laugh, but he ends up just crying. Arthur is being asked to sign autographs as he's on the phone with his attorney, even signing one with, I hope you get cancer. He's sitting with Lee at movie night, and she says that they should leave. She goes to the back of the room and lights it on fire. She kisses him in that room as she sings, If They Can See Me Now. And again, we're hitting the audience over the head with their thoughts, right? Like, she wants to be seen. She's like, if you could see me now. Everything about her singing is about being seen. Everything about him is being with somebody.
Yep. And that's the audience. The people who saw Joker and who fetishized an incel violent scene is Harley. Those are the people who did not get the fucking point of that movie, and those are the people we were warned about. Remember, that movie was gonna just unleash wanton violence across cinemas. Bullshit. All it did was have people fucking dancing downstairs and being happy. It's not what happened. But Lee is that shitty part of the audience for the first film who did want Joker.
Yeah, she is a stand-in for the audience who Todd Phillips clearly has disdain for, that glorified Joker for the quote-unquote wrong reasons.
So they head out hand-in-hand and head to the fence, not to escape, but to bask in the spotlight. They're just trying to find the light here.
They're breaking free and having fun in the yard. They're not doing what they're being accused of, but they're, yeah, it's a release.
Arthur is thrown down some stairs and dragged to his room. We then see a musical number with her and him on top of the Arkham Hotel, this time with him in complete Joker garb and makeup, and she says, there's my guy, and that she'd do anything for him.
It's kind of sad that the 45-second musical number with Marilyn Monroe and Birds of Prey was better than any musical sequence in this movie.
Lee says this is going to be good for them as she's brought makeup and says that she wants to see the real him, not knowing that's not who he really is. My question is, how did she get here? Like, I know we're going to hear later that she comes from a shit ton of money. So maybe she bought the guards in order to get here. We're going to learn that she's just not even a fucking patient here. She's just here visiting, trying to seek him out. But I'm just thinking, like, how did she get inside this fucking cell?
She either paid the guard, she slept with the guards. I was waiting to find out that she actually works there, something like that.
Yeah, she was an intern.
Yeah.
You know, heaven forbid we actually get close to what that character is.
So, Lee's applying Arthur's makeup and says it's just us now, right before they fuck.
The most unnecessary, awkward, like, this fucking, no need for this at all.
This gives the sex scene in Watchmen a run for its money as far as the amount of cringe.
The only reason it's here is because we're going to find out she's a pathological liar. But when she comes to him and says, you know, she's pregnant, it gives a little bit of credence to his psyche, like, ooh, maybe she is. That's the only reason I can think of. We cut to Arthur and his attorney, and he's getting an overview of what he's going to be asked. And he also says Lee gets him. And Keener's trying to push her off the path. She says people need to understand that he's not Joker, that he's Arthur Fleck, right before he kisses her. Another just cringe scene. Gets a lot of kissing done in this.
Yeah, in this defense, I call this the Ben Solo paradigm, where it's, oh, it wasn't me, it was Kylo Ren who killed all those people.
But this, again, as Adam and I said, this was a big thing in the 80s. People tried using this as defense a lot.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. And, I mean, the scene coming up later on is a direct homage, if you want to call it that, to the Manson interview.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're getting to that right now. So Arthur meets up with Myers, played by Steve Coogan, and this Patty character is just giving him the fucking rundown. This felt like the time when, you know, we're going to see the Joker come out, but all he's saying is that he doesn't want to die anymore and that Joker is the one who killed Murray on TV. He then says that he's not alone anymore and he now has Harley Quinzel. We get to hear that name. So this is him trying to come out, and this character is trying to interview him and trying to make that psyche come out, but it doesn't happen. I thought for sure if he was going to come out, it was going to be here, and he was going to shoot Steve Coogan, but he doesn't.
I don't know if anything's surprising me at this point, because I think it's subverting left and right, but I do think we're going to get something here. But I don't know what it's going to be, but I think we're starting to... I mean, he's emerging, but at this point, I don't think we're going to see Joker go full Joker. So I don't think we're going to that, but I think we're going to get something. But I don't know. I mean, I'm glad we're getting some acting. I'm glad we're getting something going on. But I got to say, I feel like we pulled off the interstate and we're kind of just driving through a cornfield and not really sure what the direction is.
So much of this movie feels like I'm stuck in mud and I'm sinking in quicksand because I feel like it's wasting my time. I feel like I'm on a treadmill where, yeah, I'm running, but I'm not fucking getting anywhere. And I'm waiting for that moment where something will happen. And I think this is a purposeful bit of misdirection by Phillips, that every time you think the Joker is going to pop out like the tea kettle, he takes it off the stovetop.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's purposely done to say, taking a baby's pacifier away, it's like, no, 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 you're not going to get it.
We're getting a meaningless rendition of Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered as Lee breaks the window and takes the TV.
Sinatra should sue. His ghost should sue with the amount of between this and That's Life, which they use in both movies.
We're hearing the trial of Arthur is being called the trial of the century. Boy, where have I heard that before? We're hearing some opinions of him on the radio as he smiles and laughs in the police car. He's getting a ton of support from outside the courthouse, though, as he pulls up. We're once again hearing Showtime as the door is opened and lights flood in.
Big missed opportunity here, because if you're going to incorporate the media, you should have them interviewing the supporters being like, why are you here? That whole, his influence on society is never really talked about outside of the confines of the courtroom and the people he's killed.
But I think that defeats the purpose of what Todd Phillips is trying to say here. I think he wants them to be kept in the background. We're going to get a huge thing that they do later, but I think they're purposely kept in the background because you're not going to expect what happens there. Although I'll say, I can't believe they had Phoenix give, I don't know if this was him ad-libbing or what, but he's given the Nixon V hands as he greets his fan club. Like, what the fuck was this? I guess Nixon was in the zeitgeist then.
Well, he couldn't have a MAGA hat make America Joker in the courtroom. So.
Might as well.
Now, what transpires from here is a standard set of courtroom scenes. Now, I'm a fan of courtroom dramas. We're going to get the previous film told from many points of view, which is the purpose of these scenes. But really, a trial, even calling it the trial of the century? Adam, you're a courtroom drama fan. What'd you think about the direction this took?
I was happy when we got here. I wish that we would have had a courtroom drama start at about the 35, 45 minute mark. Have the opening and get to this. I think the courtroom drama, if you're going to do it, should be the crux of the film. And I think you can weave a narration around a courtroom drama with Joker. I think that's a great fucking idea. What Phillips has is not a great fucking idea.
If you were going to go this route, then economic storytelling would have you do a recap through a news report in the first 10 minutes of the movie that gets you into the courtroom a lot quicker. And then you could intercut with the musical numbers. You get flashbacks to see why Lee is there in the first place. I think you could retake this template and make something better. So I don't think this entire movie is out of line. I mean, John Grisham made a whole subgenre in the 90s with these kind of movies. And there's a part later on where Joaquin Phoenix plays the Kevin Spacey lawyer from A Time to Kill.
Lee sings That's Entertainment as she's right outside the courthouse. We're hearing one doctor say Arthur doesn't suffer from multiple personality disorder and that he was sane while committing the crimes. Arthur is not concerned with the doctor's testimony. He's concerned with where Lee is sitting, which I think is a very telling thing. He's looking and she's right there when he's in the spotlight. When he's not, She is where the cameras are. When he's looking for her, she's on the outside getting the cameras shooting her. I think that's very telling.
And this is why I think you could have done this in a way where you didn't know if she was real or not. Because she's moving from, she's in the back row. And she continuously moves up until she's in the front row. And when she's not in the front row, he's getting the attention outside. She's the attention whore. She's the one that wants that. She's the one that wants, she needs Arthur to be Joker for her. Mm-hmm. Just like the shitty parts of the audience that need Joker to be an incel raising movie.
The public defender is really hitting the doctor hard with testimony as Arthur is having flashes to his spree. More testimony, this time from Prosecutor Harvey Dent. Lee confronts the public defender, asking why Arthur doesn't have any t-shirts in circulation and why she's not sitting closer to him in the courtroom. And it is here where we're told that everything Lee has told Arthur were lies and that she actually went to med school for a master's in psychology. Basically, he shouldn't believe a word she says.
Pretty much. And the only thing that would have been nice is if you didn't know if this was true. Because it's pretty obvious right away that the doctor is telling the truth. And if you would have had both of them playing Arthur for different reasons, maybe Arthur kills them both, you could have done something cool with this. But it doesn't matter. And that's the shitty part.
It doesn't matter should be the subtitle of this movie.
Not fully ado.
Maybe that's what it translates to in English and you read the wrong translation. I guess the musical number they should have covered is Nothing Else Matters by Metallica.
Jesus. We cut to a Sonny and Cher mock-up set as Lee and Arthur, once again in full makeup, sing again. It's here where Arthur imagines Lee shooting him in the gut. This comes back later.
Second movie we've covered that uses a Bee Gees song.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We see Arthur pretending to shoot a bunch of guards as he and the female inmate from earlier are approached and told to get up. Lee visits Arthur in prison. And she says everyone lies a little. She does admit that her dad is indeed a doctor and she comes from a very rich family. She just wanted him to like her and that she came down because she wanted to meet him. She also says the sex was great. And then she tries warning him about his lawyer. She says the lawyer doesn't care about him, but she does. She also reveals that she's pregnant, which, of course, has to be another lie.
Yeah, this also doesn't work from a storytelling standpoint because you've already revealed that she's a pathological liar.
Exactly. Unless the sequel would have consisted of her having this baby and going on another spree.
I don't care.
Yeah.
That's kind of the worst part about this reveal here. I don't care if she's lying or not. The placement of her deciding to do this, it just makes her seem like a shitty woman. And that's not this movie. I mean, that's kind of that she's trapping him. That's something different, and it feels scuzzy.
I guess this is their homage to Frank Miller's Batman, where women are just nothing but prostitutes and bad people.
We then get the money shot from the trailer, which is her drawing a smile and him lining up with it. Which, I'm sorry, even as someone who had a hand in making a few films myself, I'm still left wondering how they did that. That is an interesting shot. And it's put in your face, this is what she wants. She wants to make him Joker.
He needs it. For herself, she needs him to be Joker, because that validates her. Like I said, that's a segment of the audience.
We're hearing the testimony of ZZ Beats, which, by the way, guys, I re-listened to our podcast, and a lot of our discussion was whether or not this character actually exists. Here we get it right in our face. She's here, she's in the flesh, and she is on trial.
Well, we knew she existed in the first movie. It was the fact that she was being stalked that was the surprise.
I just couldn't believe that she came back.
Yeah.
Like, this blew me. I mean, one, it's a shame, because ZZ Beats, she blew up for all of about 30 seconds. I mean, she disappeared quick. But she does a good job. I thought she was fantastic in the first one. It took me a second. I did not realize who they would get back, because this was a shock. But it was good to see her, and it throws into question the first movie, though. And that upsets me.
In what way? Why does that upset you?
I don't need shit spelled out to me if you didn't do it before. If you purposely make something ambiguous, and that is part of why something works, do not dare turn around and take away that ambiguity.
What, that's one of the underlying points of this movie, is it's taking everything that you can perceive in the first one as being readable in multiple ways and just blanket statements everything and spoon-feed it. This movie spoon-feeds you so much information that I'm surprised no one choked and died in the assembly room.
She says that she didn't even know Arthur as much as she knew his mother. Another musical number, again in full Joker garb, as he sings The Joker Is Me.
This is like, I feel like I'm being hit with that gavel he's using.
I was just about ready to say, you know, as much as I didn't like the musical numbers in this, I did like him grabbing that gavel and just beating that fucking judge to death.
But that, well, that ties into the read that it's Martin Scorsese because he's openly beating the notion that comic book movies are stupid, even though he aped a director with entirely with his first movie. Yeah. I guess this is continuing because this is his New York, New York.
We cut to Arthur waking up and then firing his lawyer, which is exactly what Lee wanted. She tells him that they're all going crazy for him, and he did it. He responds with, maybe I need to read a law book or something. She says, you can do all you want. You're Joker. Joker then sees another riot in jail, once again as the inmates sing When the Saints Go Marching In.
God, why did he keep using this song?
I don't know. Matt, I don't know.
I was looking for something into it, and I couldn't come up with an answer.
I'm trying to rack my brain, like, okay, what is there anything in the lyrics that is, like, being played out throughout the movie? No. And, why is Brendan Gleeson here?
Yeah. I was wondering the same thing.
This movie wastes him. It wastes Steve Coogan. It wastes Zazie Beetz.
It wastes Lady Gaga.
Yep. Even Catherine Keener to a certain extent, because after this, she's gone.
Yeah.
You think at least he would have killed her or something.
Because there's
like everybody in some way wants to strangle an attorney.
Another thing I hate about what this movie does is he's here and it's implied that he's raped in prison, right? I mean, we're getting that implication. Go ahead.
This was the moment that turned me on this movie completely. Because, look, this is a prison movie cliche in and of itself. But implying sexual assault just to accentuate the thing that it's misery porn, it's one of the most tasteless plot developments I've seen in a long time. Because you could remove it, and the movie still operates. The fact that they sunk to this level to try to get empathy for a character that he is openly telling people you should not have any semblance for is insulting.
Yeah, and to imply that this is what wakes the Joker up because after this he's in full makeup is just, it's sick. It's just sick.
You didn't need to go there. And it's uncomfortable. It takes you out. I hate when people are just like, hey, trigger warning. But this is such an uncomfortable, just not needed. It's a stupid inclusion. You get the point by beating them and doing that and maybe leaving them thrown in the shower. To do it, to have it be guards, you took this to a just a unneeded place. With what happens here with his buddy, that gets the job done. Leaving him beaten in the shower, that gets the job done. To cut away as they're like undoing their belt, that's just fucking horrible. Be better. And I get it, it's cinema. That's just a shitty decision. No wonder he didn't show it to anybody, because he would have been forced to fucking cut this movie.
Arthur shows up to court in full makeup, which the judge allows, as long as he's not disruptive to the proceedings. The state then calls Puddles, the little guy Arthur stood up for in the last film, and much to his surprise, Arthur just ransacks him. I hate Joker here. I hate him. I hate him making fun of his name. I hate him talking in his redneck drawl. And just the whole thing, especially after how nice this guy was in the last film, just disturbed me. I fucking couldn't stand this scene.
I like this because of how it ends. I get that he's trying to put this on, and he's acting like Joker. He's trying to act like people expect him to be. It's funny, the foghorn, leghorn drawl. Like, I keep going back to Knives Out. When Chris Evans is like, you're a foghorn, leghorn drawl. And I know it's To Kill a Mockingbird, but because it's comedic, that's what I go. But the way that it ends, where he thinks this guy is going to stand up for him because he was nice to him. And that scene in Joker, that's a hell of a scene. When he kills the other ones, and Puddles is reaching up and can't quite get that doorknob. Like, that is some intense. That's something else. But to realize how much it fucked him up and everything else. And I think Joker, I think up to this point, he is trying to become Joker. I think at the end of him doing this, he realizes, this isn't who I am. And I think everything changes right here.
Well, first of all, I need to express a formal apology to the court that Brendan Fraser gave the most ridiculous Southern lawyer accent in Killers of the Flower Moon, because this takes the cake. I also don't like that this scene is also the moment where it's very clear that Phillips never had any empathy for Arthur's struggles at all, or Puddles for that matter. The fact he's suggesting otherwise is just reprehensible. Oh, I couldn't wait for this movie to end.
And this is also just recontextualizing what that last film meant, right, Adam, by doing this. So Dent closes his case, as Flex says the defense also rests, even using the Porky Pig "that's all folks" finally line. Another set of singing from Lee, saying that she's going to build a mountain.
If they really wanted to make this Trump, it would have been, I'm going to build a wall. I'm going to build a wall and I'm going to make the Jokers pay for it.
We cut to Arthur riding in the police car and then taken back to jail. Arthur tells the guards a joke about why his mom stayed with abusers, and they beat him. This causes Lee to sing to him while putting on the outfit and makeup that we know Harley Quinn is having.
Not really.
Well, kind of. Again, she's dressing up for him, right? I mean, this is all for him.
Yeah, she's purposely gaslighting him.
Yeah.
And I think this is why Christopher Nolan was smart to not use Harley Quinn in a movie, because whenever you try to do that outfit or that aesthetic in a quote-unquote realistic depiction, I don't think it's ever going to look 100% right.
But it's not supposed to, because she's not actually that character yet, right?
I don't know. I feel like she's Harley Quinn in name only, in the same way that this is Joker in name only.
Yeah.
See, that's where I think in Suicide Squad, they did a decent job, because you put her in that Harlequin outfit in a dream sequence for 5 seconds, and you go, okay, fuck, that doesn't look good. Nope.
Meanwhile, the judge warns Arthur that this isn't a comedy club, as he gives his final testimony. It is here where he admits to what he did and renounces the theory that Joker had anything to do with it, which is the biggest fuck you this movie actually does.
Oh, yeah, this is the middle finger coming out of the Jack in the Box.
Yep.
Because Lady Gaga was it Venice?
Yeah, they're at the Cannes Film Festival.
That's Lady Gaga there in the front row. That's Cannes going, what the fuck, and getting up and walking out.
But she wasn't here for Arthur. Like, she was here for Joker. So when she hears this, it puts her in suicide mode.
And that's the audience. That's Todd Phillips going, those of you who want to celebrate Joker, go fuck yourself.
Yep. He also says he just wanted to blow it all up and start over. He then leaves.
I think that was James Gunn's one note. That's not the movie.
He then leaves a message on Lee's answering machine saying he doesn't want her to go before singing to her again. Now, as the obvious guilty of all counts verdict is being read, incels strike yet again and the courtroom is blown up. Was not expecting this, gotta say.
Really?
No, I wasn't. I thought if anything was going to happen, and maybe this is just my stupidity, Joker and Harley were going to be behind it. I did not expect the protesters from the outside, which is why I'm glad we didn't get any attention called to them until this moment. You know, this is when we really noticed them, except for them being in the background. This is them blowing the courtroom up and pretty much saving their hero, or who they thought was their hero.
Yeah, I did think it was Harley. So to have it just be the protesters outside surprised me. So they're January 6th-ing this thing.
That's exactly what I thought of too, dude. And that is the difference in the world from 2019 to now, isn't it? In 2019, again, like in 2022, I didn't know what a fucking incel was. By this time, we had heard all of the media coverage of the Joker release and everything that was behind it and the fear that people, quote unquote, had for it. That was the media. That was not what actually happened, as Adam pointed out earlier. But this is Phillips going against that, right? This is him pointing to that and saying, yeah, this is you. This guy, this pathetic character of Arthur, is not the Joker. You are the Joker, and fuck you for liking it.
And I'm saying this, and of the three of us, I'm the right winger on the show. And yeah. I realize that this is what he is saying, and he's right.
So I thought this was, I'm like, all right, this must be what pissed people off, because I thought he was going to be killed in the explosion. And it was going to be, will the real Joker please stand up? And he would walk in and sort of, quote unquote, reveal himself. I thought this was going to be it, but then they show him move around. I'm like, okay, first of all, how the fuck did he survive that explosion based on where the stuff fell off? And I also groaned when they cut to Harvey dead and half of his face is missing.
Love it. Love it. I love how much that pisses people off, because I've heard a lot of that too. We get a citywide view of the result of the explosion, and as Matt mentioned, we see Dent with his face kind of blown off as Arthur's walking around. Adam, I take it you hated this too.
I was okay because it panned by it, and I know that they're not going to go anywhere with it. We're not going to continue in this universe, no. So I'm okay with it. I got a problem with what happens here in a minute, but I'm okay with this.
Well, I was thinking of other, like, contingency plans in my head as what would piss people off. The bomb is like a representation of his medicine kicking in, and we found out the whole movie was a dream.
Oh, shit.
And I would have said, okay.
I'm getting there.
That would have pissed people off. But I would have been like, okay, you got balls of steel for doing that. Don't say that because Superman is around the corner.
Matt, it goes back to what we were saying, right? The three of us posted the trailer, when it was released 5-6 months ago. And Matt and I both said, this is all in his head. As soon as that trailer was released. And they had gone that route. Oh, my fucking God. Serenity would have had nothing on that fucking ending.
Oh, they would have deep-faked Bob Newhart's ghost to be like, see, I'm not the only one who did it.
So Arthur's walking around. He walks by a Joker fanatic, fully dressed as a Joker. Who knows? This guy can be the one who's responsible. Arthur doesn't want to go with him. See, Arthur didn't want to start all this. He doesn't want to be any part of this whatsoever.
This pisses me off so much. This was the tease that they leaked, quote-unquote, first. This was the part of the trailer that they also squeezed out, that you had him running through the streets encountering different versions of the Joker. This was purposely teased to be like, oh, we're going to see such a fucked up in the head type of Joker. And it's not. It's just people in cosplay. Thank God my popcorn bucket was empty.
Is it bad that I fucking loved it?
Yes. I mean, I get it. And it's, again, it's my problem because of the expectation. But they put it out there that he was running from himself. And I guess in a way he is, but all you did was literalize it, which is from 2 hours now has been the problem.
So they put Arthur in their car as they flip off fire trucks as they're driving by and news reports are being read. And then he gets out, and as Adam said, he's running through the streets. He sees Lee on the steps as he climbs them and sees that she is nothing if not disappointed. She thought that she was falling in love with the Joker, but now is disgusted with who she has fucked because she sure as hell didn't want him to be Arthur.
This is 75% of the credit. This Absolutely. Is your Metacritic score. Yeah. Right here on the step. I love that fact.
I also thought this was the moment where either he pushes her down the stairs and kills her, or vice versa.
I thought she was going to shoot him and, kick him down the stairs. And I think they might have had that. I think there could be something where that was shot.
I'm sure, for the record, this movie is like Clue, where there's five different endings.
Yeah, I do know that there were about five endings shot for this. That could have been one of them.
And all of them missed the target.
Lee says that she's not going with him, as all they had was the fantasy, and he just gave up. She reminds him that he said there is no Joker, and responds with his pronouncing that they're having a baby while singing a song. She says goodbye and climbs the steps away from him. We then see him leaning his head on a cop car window, and then we're seeing him watch Pepe Le Pew.
Who is the biggest villain in this movie, by the way.
Now, when I saw this white shirt he was wearing, I knew that this was going to get splattered with blood, because why else would you have him in this? But it's not bad enough that Todd Phillips has already given the big fuck you to all the people who loved that last movie. He's going to kick you while you're down, because as Arthur is walking in the hall, we see that prisoner from earlier. He tells him a joke and then plunges a knife into his gut. We cut to him and Lee back on the Sonny and Cher set as he's leaning over after being shot by her. And then we see the prisoner slicing a grin on his face.
Barely. You got to pay attention.
You got to pay attention, but it's there.
It's out of focus.
Yeah, but it's there. And it's something that, Matt, I know this is what you're referring to. They wanted to do this in the last film, and Nolan was like, no. Only Heath Ledger's Joker is able to do this. So they do it here.
Yeah, well, it's not just the association with Heath Ledger, it's the whole thing of him being killed at the end of the movie by, quote-unquote, the real Joker. Regardless of the fact that I sort of predicted this was going to be the out, it didn't anger me as much as I thought it would, because that's like the ultimate, to use the pun, that is the ultimate punchline Todd Phillips could have thrown. That the character you've been following for two movies is not who you thought he was. But what did piss me off was the Glasgow smile. I thought that was... That is not the performance or the version of the character that you should be trying to pay homage to, because you are nowhere near close. You might as well have had him also say, you ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight, and then he stabs him.
See, I don't think he's saying this is the real Joker. I think he's saying any of these.
No, I think that's such an obvious pull that there's no way you can ignore that. Especially, they try to get around it by doing it in the background and out of focus, which, again, I also find just distasteful.
I find Nolan to be a little too self-serious. And for those that don't remember, I fucking adore Chris Nolan films. I can't wait to see Interstellar back in theaters this December, everybody. But there has been more than one Joker that has carved their face. So I don't have as big of a problem as a lot of people do. Now, when this scene happened, and I did not get a chance to go back and see this again, I kind of need this on digital or DVD. I'm trying to see how this ending walk lines up with the beginning of the film, because at the beginning they take him out of a cell, he walks through that room the exact same way that he does at the end of the film. I'm trying to figure out, is this entire movie what he sees as he's laying here dying? Because I think it's possible. I'm trying to line it up. Literally the beginning, they take him out of his cell, and he is there in the back of the room here at the end the exact same way as he is at the very beginning of the film when he walks through that common room and walks through. Did he get killed 5 minutes into this film? And this entire film is his death watch. I think it's possible, and if so, I enjoy this film more. As it is, I'm just like, I can't believe he had the balls to do this, and do I think it's a good idea? No. What I do like is that it's going to piss everybody.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
It's been a long time since we've had a movie ending piss off general audiences. Yeah. For this. Like, I'm trying to think of the last one where I'd probably have to go back to, like, a Shyamalan.
Yeah, probably.
Or that 9/11 movie with Robert Pattinson.
Oh, God.
This is a Joker-type ending of, you think you know what you're going to get? You have no idea.
And Adam, fortunately for you, you won't have to wait long for it to come on digital.
That's the truth.
All right. As Arthur's laying dying, credits roll on Joker fully adieu. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give this movie? Adam, go ahead, sir.
Movie I didn't need, a movie I didn't want, and at the end of the day, walking out of the theater... What, 2 hours 20? 2 hours 40 when you're factoring in all the fucking ridiculous commercials and trailers and everything else. I still don't know if I need this movie. I'm not angry at it like a lot of people are. I am disappointed in it that it recontextualizes so much of the first film that I enjoyed as a piece of art. And partially that's the point, is Todd Phillips is saying, those of you that can't appreciate just an artistic film and you need a superhero villain to be your hero, you're fucked up. You are Harley Quinn, and he's telling you that. But I don't necessarily like the way that it's done. The opening 35 minutes-ish of this movie is slow, is boring, and I'm glad I saw it in the afternoon because I would have fallen asleep if I would have seen it at night. And this is like the third movie in a row. This is as bad. I railed against the opening 40 minutes of Beetlejuice, and this took me back to that where I was like, get the fuck on with this movie, please. But it gets better, but it is unfocused. And even in its design, when you're going to unfocus a movie deliberately, there's got to be a filmmaker focus in mind. And that's not here. I like the distraction with the musical numbers. I think they work in what we're being told here. I think the symbolism of Harley killing Joker in the final dance sequence is what the audience did to Todd Phillips' Joker. So I think he's telling what he has here. It's an unfulfilling movie. It's a companion piece, to Matt's point, that is almost like a commentary track. And it's an expensive one at that. I don't need any more in this. I don't want it. It doesn't lessen the original film because the original is there. It stands on its own. It exists. So I don't believe in those that say that it ruins the first film. It hurts watching this film. When you're watching it, does kind of slap you with what that first film was supposed to be and what it is. And to that, it's a disappointment. Todd Phillips, he made his point. If they were going to push and pressure him into a movie, he did it his way. And so did Joaquin Phoenix, and I at least admire him for that. But it's not a good movie in any sense of the word. I do think it's worth watching. The cinematography gets good. The acting is as good as it was last time, almost. But what they're given to do is nowhere near as good. I loved Joker. I appreciate this one, but I can't say it's a good movie. I'm not going to say it's bad, but you better adjust your expectations for what you think you're going to get. I'm going to give it a 6. I think I'm going to be the highest of this group because I appreciate it, even if I don't like it.
All right. 6 out of 10 from the fan of the previous film. Matt, as the non-fan, well, as one of the non-fans of the last film, what do you have to say, sir? What's your rating?
Don't act like I'm the only person.
No, you're not.
You know, I have a propensity and a bit of a reputation for liking movies that are unapologetically bad from the directors. I love Showgirls as a shining example. But Paul Verhoeven at least owns that he made a bad movie. This is what happens, to use a school analogy, when the one mediocre kid somehow got an A on a test, but everyone knew that happened just because he sat next to the right kid and just copied off him. So then when the time came for the next test at the end of the semester, the smart kid changed seats. So the kid said, you know what, to hell with this. I'm going to pick B for every answer just because I need some kind of manic system to get my point across. Suffice it to say, this movie was fucking garbage. And if I was a teacher, I would have thrown it in that appropriate spot. I think me calling it a $200 million middle finger summarizes everything that I could encapsulate in a written review if I chose to do one. I found this to be, for the most part, pretty excruciating to sit through. And even if I was someone who liked the first movie, of which I'm not, I've made that abundantly clear, I wonder, outside of Adam, because he sort of hinted at this, I wonder if there's going to be people who kind of retroactively don't like the first film now because they've seen where it leads. We've unfortunately had sequels kind of do that to the first one. Although I think if a first movie is great, it'll always stand the test of time, because I'm pretty good at keeping it just in that view. But when you make something this, I don't know, ballsy, for all the chutzpah to put this together, at the end of the day, it's a big contradiction. Like I said with Todd Phillips' commentary, and I feel like this was made just to gaslight people, of which I don't fall into that group, but is this the worst comic movie ever made? Nope. I don't even think it's the worst movie in our Batman retrospective, but I think this is one of the few that I will have next to no interest to go back and rewatch. And I can't wait to see in the coming years if this movie becomes that hipster thing where they reassess it as, oh, the movie was secretly brilliant this whole time. And if that happens, I will believe then we can colonize in space and the impossible actually happens. So this was bullshit. I'm going to go the fully ado in the title and give this a 2 out of 10.
Wow.
Because it's not the worst movie I've seen this year. That's the crazy thing. Much as I hated this, I've still seen worse.
2 out of 10. Holy shit. Gremlins 2. Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. The video game Metal Gear Solid 2. Sons of Liberty. These are all things that were done in response to the love the previous entries had, and pretty much pointed the finger at the audience and said, fuck you for liking it. That is exactly what Todd Phillips is doing here. And as somebody who was not a fan of the previous movie, I respected the gall of him to do that. And look, I've talked about what I really did not like about this movie. I think if a couple years down the line, somebody makes a fan edit of this and cuts the songs out of this movie and makes it just a plain movie, I don't think anything will be taken away from it. I think that that would make a pretty good 2-hour movie. I'm sorry. Coming into this, I did not think I would have any love for this whatsoever. It's not just the critical consensus going in, because you couldn't get away from the 70% of people who walked out not liking it, critics and audiences included. It was me saying, okay, are they going to take this Harley Quinn character, connect her with the Joker, and make something where they go on the crime spree and they take over Gotham? No. Todd Phillips is not going to give people that satisfaction. And to take and reconceptualize everything that happened in that first movie and turn it into what this is, I respect the balls to take something and just totally punk it up. That's what he did. I've gone over the performances. I think the performances are good. I think Joaquin Phoenix is very good. I think Lady Gaga is pretty good in a role that, as I mentioned, is pretty much just a device. Now, the musical numbers in this movie take my score down a full 2 points, because my biggest hurdle with this movie was the goddamn music. By the way, it was sung by people who have had musical careers in the past. Yes, Joaquin Phoenix has had a rap career. People go back and check. But they're singing songs that, A, I didn't like to begin with, and B, are done terribly. The songs in this movie are flat out awful. And Lady Gaga's renditions of them on that album, they're better, but I cannot endorse something that does this and makes you sit through it. So that being said, the story against the music, well, it would have been a 7, but I'm knocking it down to a 5. It's a 5 out of 10, the exact same score I gave the previous film. And I do think there will be a groundswell in the years to come of people saying, after the hate dies down, of people saying, you know what, that wasn't too bad a movie. And I do think there will be think pieces and things that come out about what Todd Phillips was trying to say. But if they do what Matt said and go back and listen to that commentary, they should take it all back according to what he said. But still, I respected it enough to give it a 5. But will people want more? Obviously, they're not. I'm pretty sure this is a closed-off universe. Matt, would you agree? I mean, there's no way that we'll take this to other levels, is there?
Dead is a doornail. Not just because of how the movie ends. I think that, like, I can't see any way Todd Phillips is ever involved again. I think Joaquin is done. Gaga's going to move on to better things. And with the fact that we're getting a whole new rebooted DC continuity, I don't see any way this continues. If it does, I will be shocked, but I think the likelihood of that is pretty close to 0.
Yeah, I think this is it. If I was Matt Reeves, I hope I would have got paid up front. That's how much I think this might end anything that is not DC Studios. I think this is it. I think with Superman coming out July next year, I think that if you are not released in 2024, you are not going to be a DC film that's coming out. So I think we saw the last of Joaquin Phoenix, and I think with that, we've seen the only appearance of Robert Pattinson. I think that's how much this puts a nail in their extended universe that they said they were going to do. I do not think we see Elseworlds at DC.
I think we will, just because the Penguin is doing so well.
That might be what saves it, because that thing is, the media attention that that is getting is ridiculous.
In a lot of ways, that show has outshined the movie. Yep. When you look at the way people are talking about it, movies and critics, I mean, it's getting huge awards pushes. The Matt Reeves universe will continue, regardless. If they have to recast Batman, they will.
Is Matt Reeves involved in that show?
Just as a producer. I thought he wrote and directed the pilot. I was surprised that he didn't. I swore he did.
The showrunner is Lauren LaFranc, but, I mean, I can't say enough good things about that show.
And there are plans for us to cover it in some form later on down the road, so stay tuned for that.
And I will say, just to continue on that, I think that that universe will continue as an independent thing. Maybe not necessarily as a movie, but you'll keep getting shows like The Penguin. Maybe you'll get they'll revisit that Arkham Asylum show they've been talking about.
They may do full No Man's Land with each villain. That's what this show is.
Yeah, and I think there's more than enough actors who could replace Pattinson and people wouldn't even notice. Because now that we're almost 3 years removed from that movie, which is hard to believe, I don't think it's had the staying power that people thought it would. I think Pattinson was fine, but I don't think he's irreplaceable.
Well, in order for it to stay in people's minds, you got to make another one, and they haven't.
Well, I think this show is the reason why that second one will actually be made now. But let's also remember that sequel is not slated to come out until October of 26. That's a full 2 years from now.
All right. As far as, I mean, I love that Todd Phillips just set off a bomb that just destroyed all DC IP universe filmmaking. It makes me laugh. But what will we get next? That's to come. So until next week, with this podcast, you get what you fucking deserve. Thank you, boys.
Prince was good, his was better.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast.
I read your work. Insightful. Naive, but insightful.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Ooh. Talk about your cold shoulder.
Just a note, the three Chris Nolan films are not going to be part of this retrospective, as they were covered by Matt and Garrett on the Binge Movie Aftertaste just a few years ago.
Never rub another man's rhubarb.
To hear those takes, please head over to www.bingemedia.net.
Okay, go ahead. Intimidate me. Bully me if it makes you feel big. I mean, it's not like you can just kill me.
Actually, it's a lot like that.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Tonight's forecast, a freeze is coming.
Voice narration by Adam.
I hate when people talk during the movie.
Edited by Garrett.
That miserable, waddling mountebank of a bird. He couldn't finish a bag of popcorn.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
gotta go. So many people to kill, so little time.
Bob? Done.
I'm not going to say just as good because there is a certain amount of familiarity. Like, there's not that surprise component like there was with the first one, but I think it's pretty close. I think the accusations that he phoned this in are a step too far.
That's funny. You have a phone ringing in the background and you said that.
Bob? Done.
I thought there was one that could have pulled that would have gotten people more upset, but we'll save that for the end. I got to use the bathroom, so keep going.
We can wait.
All right.
I knew the discussion was going to go like this. I fucking knew it. I can't believe it. You know, when I took notes for this, I got finished and I was like, God, you know what? This is less notes than I usually have. I think this is going to be a relatively short podcast. Nope. Nope. That's not happening.
No, I mean, you know, we're 10 minutes in.
Bob? Done.
All the singing in this movie, guys, is fucking terrible. Now, this is being said by a non-musical fan. So I gotta ask, Matt, what'd you think about the inclusion of music here?
Are you sure you want to go to me first? Because Adam sounded like he was ready to fight you just now.
Oh, okay. Adam, go.
I mean, come on. We all watched I'm Still Here, right? You know? Oh, who remembers David Letterman? Oh my gosh, shit. Him on David Letterman.
Yeah.
And Joker on Murray. Oh my god. I never put that together. Holy fuck.
Yeah, people forget Joaquin Phoenix also had a singing career.
But I mean, just when he went on David Letterman and he stayed in care. Oh my god. Yeah. Watching that with this, that just, fuck, that hit my head.
Yeah, people thought he lost his mind.
Yeah.
Which he probably did. Yeah. But he was great in Walk the Line. His co-star sucked, but he was great.
She won the Oscar.
That's yeah, she won the fucking Oscar.
Yeah, she can dig herself a grave with her spoon, as far as I'm concerned. Fuck her.
Wow.
Yep.
So Reese Witherspoon should have
Yeah, I was gonna say, no Freeway review anytime soon, I guess.
I love the musical breaks in this film.
Bob, done.
But I agree with you guys in that if you're going to do it, go all out. Why did they just fucking strip it down like this?
And they also... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's why I don't believe this thing cost...
Bob? Done.
She either paid the guard, she slept with the guards. I was waiting to find out that she actually works there. Something like that.
Yeah, she was an intern.
Yeah.
You know, heaven forbid we actually get close to what that character is.
She's here for the applause, applause, applause. She...
Well, I mean, this movie literally is a bad romance.
Yeah, right. Keep your poker face, Matt. Keep your poker face on till the end. So, Lee's applying Arthur's makeup.
Bob, done.
And why is Brendan Gleeson here?
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing.
This movie wastes him. It wastes Steve Coogan. It wastes Zazie Beetz.
It wastes Lady Gaga.
Yep. who's the other person I was thinking of? Oh, yeah, I was going to say, even Catherine Keener to a certain extent, because after this, she's gone.
Bob, done.
I don't know. I feel like she's Harley Quinn in name only, in the same way that this is Joker in name only.
Yeah.
See, that's where I think in Suicide Squad, they did a decent job because you put her in that Harlequin outfit in a dream sequence for 5 seconds and you go, okay, fuck, that doesn't look good. Nope.
Yeah, and then they went the other extreme of making an outfit that is so overly sexualized, I thought Michael Bay directed the movie.
Let's not go back to that discussion.
Stupid
Please,
video game outfit.
Let's not go back to that discussion. Meanwhile,
Bob, done.
I find Nolan to be a little too self-serious, as much as he says that Fast and Furious is one of his favorite.
No, Nolan being self-serious? No!
As much as he says Fast and Furious is one of his favorite franchises, I'll never reconcile him.
He's full of shit about that, by the way. That's his way of trying to, like, appeal to teenagers that, oh yeah, go see Oppenheimer.
And for those that don't remember,
Bob, done.